From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, a conversation with one of the pioneers of gangster rap, Ice-T. His 1993 song, Cop Killer, caused a furor about the place of rap in American culture. He's just released a greatest hit CD. In addition to his music career, Ice-T is also an actor. This fall, he'll play one of the detectives on NBC's Law & Order Special Victims Unit. Also, the director of Bonnie and Clyde, Little Big Man, The Miracle Worker, and Alice's Restaurant, Arthur Penn. At the age of 77, he's just been hired as executive producer of the show Law & Order. And guest critic Henry Sheehan reviews the new film, Bring It On. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Ice-T was one of the most controversial performers of the first wave of gangster rap. Gangster rap was despised by many who saw it as glorifying and glamorizing gangs, guns, drugs, and fast sex. Ice-T came under attack for his 1993 release Cop Killer, which critics claimed epitomized everything that's wrong with the music. But Ice-T says he raps about the truth of the life he once led. He has a new album, Greatest Hits, The Evidence, a collection of classic rap tracks from the last 15 years. Ice-T's voice and persona attracted Hollywood early on. He co-starred in the films New Jack City, Trespass, and Mnemonic, and has many television credits as well. This coming season, Ice-T joins the cast of the primetime NBC series Law & Order Special Victims Unit as Detective Munch's partner. Terry spoke with Ice-T in 1994, after the publication of his autobiography. Let's start with a rap that draws on Ice-T's life. This is That's How I'm Living from his album Home Invasion.
I was born in New Jersey. I said it before, but I guess nobody heard me. My mother died young. No sisters or brothers. I was the only son. When I was 12, my pops died too. What's a brother supposed to do? They sent me out west to live with my aunt. I guess they thought that was the best. But there was no love there. But growing with no moms, I guess I was prepared to live in a vacuum. The bedroom, the kitchen, the hall, the bathroom. I didn't leave home much. Didn't like LA. Didn't have no friends to trust. Got bused to a school. Blacks and whites, I guess the shit was cool. But by high school I changed. Didn't want to bust, didn't want to play the game. I walked to Crenshaw High. It was fly. I hooked up with a new crew. Some brothers that seemed like they knew what the fuck to do. You might call it a gang, but we call it a sect. And it was our own thing. The whole school was down. And one way or another, everybody fucked around. Whether hardcore or not, you wore the right color or your ass got shot. That's how I'm living. That's how I'm living.
When Terry spoke with Ice-T, she asked him whether he related to something called party rap, which was popular when he was just starting out.
When I first got off into rap, I tried to rap in the party rap type style because I was under the impression that's what rappers did. But it was kind of like I was faking it because I had never really rapped in parties and things like that. I was trying to rap like Sugar Hill Gang. And then I just started rapping about the life I was living. And that's how, you know, they call it gangster rap, but I call it reality-based rap, you know. And that's how that form of music got started.
Now, how did you start doing that? What was the turning point where you decided you weren't going to try to fake it and do the party raps, that you were going to talk about the life you knew?
Well, I made my first record ever I made was a record called Coldest Rap, and it was on a record called Cold Wind. One side was called Cold Wind Madness, and that was on an independent label. And it was very reality-based, but it was so early in rap. This was like 1982. And everybody else was rapping, you know, Run DMC style, LL Cool J and stuff. So I just was going along with the trend, you know, the way they go. But then after a while, my friends were like, you know, Ice, man, talk about what we do, man. Talk about how we live. And I did this song called Six in the Morning. It was a B-side. I really didn't think that that was what people wanted to hear. But the B-side turned out to be the biggest record and ended up being my identity, really.
Could you do a couple of lines from that?
What, 6 in the morning?
Maybe not, huh?
Yeah, I could do it. You know, okay. I mean, it went 6 in the morning, police at my door, fresh Adidas squeaked across the bathroom floor, out the back window, I made my escape. Didn't even get a chance to grab my old school tape, mad with no music, but happy because free, and the streets to a player is the place to be. Got a knot in my pocket, weighing least a grand, gold on my neck, my pistol's close at hand. I'm a self-made monster of the city streets, remotely controlled by hard hip-hop beats. But just living in the city is a serious task. Didn't know what the cops wanted, didn't have time to ask.
Now, what was the very first time you took a microphone?
I was in the Army, and the record called Rapper's Delight had came out. And that was the first time I'd ever really heard it done to music. And on the B side of it, it was an instrumental. So here I am trying to say my rhymes over this instrumental. And they didn't really fit because they weren't written that way, you know. But that was my first attempt. And I came home attempting to do what, you know, they call rapping now.
Do you remember anything you said that very first time?
Well, I tried to say the street rhymes that I had been saying on the streets, you know, strolling through the city in the middle of my night, niggas on my left and niggas on my right. I used to sing like gang rhymes. I used to say rhymes that had to do with living in the streets, you know, and they just didn't fit, you know. But I started writing like party rhymes, like my name is Ice-T, I'm here, I'm your DJ tonight, I'm here to rock y'all hard, I'm gonna rock you right, I'm gonna move you in, I'm gonna move you out, that kind of stuff. But that wasn't really what I was about, so I got back to the drama.
Right, right. And then did you feel like you had to find a different kind of music to fit it?
No, because music to me was the second thing. I was into the rhyming and the poetry that was involved. You know, the music always got in the way. And when we started doing the albums, I made a conscious decision never to make music that was danceable. Like, no, I didn't want to make dance-orientated beats. At this point now, we're starting to move more toward that, to try to make music that you can bounce to along with listening to the lyrics. But, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you've even criticized some hardcore rappers who abandon hardcore and do more dance music. What's wrong with dance music?
No, nothing's wrong with it. But, I mean, hardcore rap, it, to me, is the difference between pop and hardcore. Is with hardcore, you're saying exactly what's on your mind. You're being true to your feelings. Now, whether that pushes somebody the wrong way, that's just what being real is about. But there's a lot of people out there that want to get on the radio. So the radio dictates to you what you have to say. You have to be politically correct, so to speak. And when I see guys that at one time were very aggressive about certain things, and then I see them get softer to try to go onto the radio, I just, you know, to me that's weak, you know. But I never really pull names. I just say it to them because kind of breaks my heart when I see somebody who used to be real dancing around on the video looking all stupid. Now, well, if that's what you do, don't get me wrong. If you are a pop rapper, I have no problem with that. You know, I love MC Hammer. I love Fresh Prince, and I love Kid and Play. That's them. I'm talking about it's like tomorrow if you went out and you saw one of my videos and all of a sudden I got on some, like, a yellow raincoat and I'm dancing around and you know, you'd be like, what are you doing? That's what I'm talking about.
When you started making records, though, did you ever worry that all the traditional avenues that people hear records would be closed to you? It wasn't going to be in the jukeboxes or on the radio because of four-letter words.
I really didn't care because, to me, I did it to have fun. It was fun. It turned into being an occupation, but you got to remember, when I started rapping, nobody was making any money at it. There was Run DMC. It was like, now kids listen to it and say, oh, wow, I can get paid. Mm-hmm. But me, I did it for fun. And that was my only, like, prerequisite as far as doing music, and still is with entertainment. It's like, if I can't have fun, I can't do it. I mean, that's one of the main reasons I pulled off Warner Brothers, is because I got to be able to do it my way. If I can't have fun, then why would I write a book or make I got to do it my way. That's what it's about.
When you're rapping, do you think of yourself as doing it in persona, or is that everything you say is you?
Oh, there's lots of ways to rap. Sometimes I want to become characters, and I can play a drug dealer or a drug addict. You know, I could become any person. You know, like in Cop Killer, I became a psychopath that went on a rampage. You know, that's not me. I'm not a psychopath that went on a rampage. I make records, you know. So it's like I become certain people. Other times, I say just crazy things, and other times I say things that are totally sincere and true, and I mean them. That's the hard part about understanding rap. It takes a real rap fan to really know. And within one sentence, I can go from fact to fiction to total fiction back to something I definitely mean.
Do you want your fans to know the difference between what's a character and what's really you?
Yeah, that's why when I do interviews and I talk to people, I don't come on and try to act hard and whoop whoop and all that old extra stuff. You know, I try to be normal. I mean, I drink milk. I play video games. I bounce my little baby on my knee. I'm a normal person. It's like, you know, I mean, it's like I always compare it to like horror film writers and producers. If you met Stephen King, I don't know, would you expect him to reach over and pull your heart out of your chest, or would you think that he's just a writer? It's like that, you know. Everybody's capable of making up insane characters. I mean, I got a tough side to me, but I don't have to walk around and, flaunt it. I don't need to do that.
Before you started rapping, were you really good at talking? Could you talk your way out of tough situations and talk your way, to use that as a con, too, when you needed it?
Exactly. I'm a much better talker than I am a fighter. I'm not really into, conflicts with people, and I went to school and I did fairly well in my last few years of school when I realized that education was something that was necessary. And I can talk. I mean, that's what I really do for a living now. So I've learned to even talk better since I've been in the music business, and I've been doing so many interviews and been in so many debates and stuff. So I read a lot more now and, try to keep my skills up.
What have you been reading?
Well, we're reading right here. We're just reading America's Military Policy on Small Wars.
Is this in a magazine or is that a
book? No, it's a little book I just got here. This is the case of El Salvador. I'm into information stuff. Anything I can, I learned a word in this book. I just found this word. You know what PSYOPS is?
Spell it for me.
PSYOPS. P-S-Y.
Oh, Special Service. You tell me.
PSYOPS.
Right. Psychological Operations or something?
Yeah. So I'm learning about that. So you'll hear that in a rap. So I suck up information and try to put it back out on a beat, because I know everybody ain't going to read this book. You know, they say, there's a sad black joke. They say, how do you hide something from somebody black? You put it in a book. So I'm aware that a lot of, my peers won't pick up books. So I pick them up and try to distribute the information another way.
Uh-huh. Now, you grew up in New York.
You know what that word meant, boy. I need to come kick it with you for a little while.
I end up interviewing the people who write these books. you grew up in New York, at least when you were very young.
Yeah,
New York.
New Jersey,
yeah. Thank you. And your parents died when you were young. Both of your parents were dead, I think, by the time you were 12. Can I ask how they died?
My mother died from a heart attack. And my father just died. I don't know. I just was called from school one day, and they're like, your pops is dead. And I'm like, oh. And then, I never really got into his actual cause of death. He wasn't killed or anything, He was, at the time, he had gone through a lot of pain, like arthritis and stuff like that. And they sent me from there. They told me, okay, well, you're going to come to L.A. for the summer.
Who's they? Who told you?
His sister, my aunt. Uh-huh. And then they were, then the next, before, when I got there in like 1 week, then all of a sudden all my clothes popped up out there in boxes. So I kind of like got shipped to California.
So that's how you ended up in L.A.?
Yeah, living with my father's younger sister, who wasn't really a nice woman. She was kind of like a woman who said, I'm taking care of you because I got to shut up, sit down, all that. So a lot of kids get moved around like that.
In your book, you said that she was a religious woman?
Nah, she wasn't a religious woman. She was a drunk. She was a social worker, a woman who would go around and analyze whether kids should stay in foster homes and stuff. And she was a terrible person. She's like old drunk. She wasn't nobody qualified to do anything like that. It was rough on me, but I left there when I was like 17 years old because, that's not the kind of environment you're supposed to be raised in, where somebody's like, I'm taking care of you because I gotta, and all that kind of stuff. The word love and caring and all that's, not even in the house.
So where did you go at 17?
I got my own place. I took a little money I was getting for Social Security. I was receiving Social Security check, $250 a month. And I got an apartment, which was $100 a month. I took another $100 and put it into the food and stuff I had to buy, and I had $50 extra, and I was still in high school.
Now, what high school were you going to?
Crenshaw.
This was in South Central?
Yeah, dead the center of that's the dead center of Los Angeles, Crenshaw High School.
Now, if I have this straight, you had been, I think, at the suggestion of your aunt, bused to an integrated school that you didn't like. And then you wanted to go to school in South Central?
Well, not really. She lived in a nice area of Los Angeles. They lived in an area called Baldwin Hills. She lived in a nice neighborhood. It's like upper class blacks.
Uh-huh.
And all the kids from that neighborhood got bused. I had no choice in busing to junior high. But when I got time to go to high school, a lot of those kids from up there wanted to continue to get bused to Palisades High, which was another, you know, white high school. But there was a Crenshaw High School was right across the street. It was walking distance, you know? So I was like, I don't want to catch the bus. I'll walk to Crenshaw. Everybody in the hills were like, ooh, you don't want to go to Crenshaw, though, you know? I'm like, why not, you know? And so I just walked across the street to the school that was closer.
Ice-T from a 1994 interview with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air.
Back with Ice-T. So when you started going to Crenshaw High School in South Central, did you fall in with a different group of people than you'd been friends with before?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because in the hills, you don't have no friends, you know? I mean, there's not that many kids up in there. It's different, you know? They're, like, different kinds of kids. And I don't know why, but I've always been, like, really based in real people, you know? And I got to Crenshaw High School, and I hooked up with the gangs, you know? Because the whole school was being operated by gangs. So these guys, I didn't look like I was joining a gang. I just looked like they were my friends, you know. And I was all more of an affiliate member. I never really would claim a particular set, but I was known by a lot of the gang members. And that particular school was a Crip school. And I didn't see anything wrong with them. I mean, I got a lot of love. I got more love from my friends and their parents than I ever got at home.
Is that part of the reason why you wanted to be with them?
Well, I had no options. I was just down there. So now here I am. I got my own apartment, and I'm starting to hang out with all these different kids. But it was real cool, you know what I'm saying? And their parents weren't like my aunt, uppity aunt. They were like, yo, you know, you cool, you know, you my baby now. And it was cool. And I would go over to their house and eat dinner and kick it with them. And it was real. There's a lot of love in the ghetto. It's a lot of love there, much more than upper class people lock their doors to most people. They don't cross it around.
It must have been good to have your own apartment. I mean, when you're in high school, somebody's got their own apartment. That's
makes you the man.
Yeah.
Well, that did happen. You know, all my friends and stuff I got, you know, I had the pad, and it turned me like into a leader, you know. So by just being a little bit in front of everybody else, I have friends always over. They could spend the night. It was funny, a lot of people would run away for like 2 days. I'm running away, I'm living with you. You know, you can't run away. Then their mother would come to my house and like, where's Nate? You know, like, get out of here. He's hiding in the closet. You know, it was interesting. But also what ended up happening, I ended up having a teenage pregnancy too.
A girlfriend?
Yeah, my girlfriend. She was in the 10th grade, but you know, I'm Mr. Man at about town, got my own apartment, whoop, now I got a baby. So, you know.
So what'd you do?
A little too much freedom, huh? At that point, I tried to stay down with the kid, but you know, that's when all of a sudden a bit of responsibility tried to hit me, and that's when I joined the military.
But that meant getting away from the baby, right?
Not really. It was just a job. It was a way of doing something. You know, at that point, I was on the streets. I was trying to go to technical college, but, you know, crime was knocking there at my door like, hey, man, you know, you only got 50 extra bucks. If you steal this car radio, you got 300 extra bucks. So what are you going to do? You know, you can't get a job at this point, you know. So it was a cross. And I just said, yeah, I'm going to try to go in the Army. and I went in the Army.
So are you still in touch with the woman who had the baby and with the baby?
Yeah, my daughter lives with me now.
Oh, she does?
Yeah.
Oh.
So that's cool and stuff, you know. But, you know, I went, when I came out of the Army, all my friends who were small-time little, you know, petty crooks now were bigger crooks, you know. And that's how I got off involved in all the different, you know, crimes, attempting to, you know, get over.
So what kind of crimes were they doing?
Everything. You know, you name it, we did it, you know. But basically anything, everything that you could do without actually bringing bodily harm to somebody. I didn't hang around with a bunch of violent guys that were into, you know, hurting people and kidnapping. But they would rob a store, burglarize something or steal something. And some of them sold drugs and things like that. But, you know, I never was like off into just, you know, the mugging type of a thing.
Mm-hmm. But did the crimes often turn to violence, like armed robbery? Did anyone ever have to use the weapon?
Yeah, well, crime always will turn to violence eventually, you know? I mean, even if you say, hey, I'm just going to sell weed, eventually if you're going to sell enough weed to get a car. But if you want a house, you got to sell much more of it. By the time you sell that, now you become a target for the lower-rung criminals who are like, hey, I don't want to sell nothing. I just want to jack whoever got the money. So eventually, you're going to have to use your muscle. And, you know, if that's not what you want to do, you're going to have to find another occupation. Some people vow for the violence in it. I never wanted to do that, you know. And it don't make me no softer to say that. You know, a lot of kids are like, oh, well, that's soft. But, Don, I ain't, you know, I'm just real about it. You know, I mean, to me, violence is a last resort, and it's a protection thing. It's defense.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ice-T spoke with Terry Gross in 1994. His new album is Greatest Hits, The Evidence. Ice-T appears next season as a detective on the NBC drama Law & Order Special Victims Unit. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Living large as possible, posse unstoppable. Style topical is vividly optical. Listen, you'll see them. Sometimes I'll be in cops, critics, and punks. Never ever want to see me in power. Well, that's too bad. Apocalypse Now, I'm back and I'm mad. We're coming. You're running cold and cunning. Ice-T on the mic. Top gunning. After your neck. Check and respect. Making you sweat. Rhyme syndicate, boy, in effect. The rap motivated teacher Parker.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a week-long series on television. First, we'll feature interviews with former child sitcom stars Ron Howard, Patty Duke, and Sheila Kuehl. And we'll hear from Sherwood Schwartz, creator of Gilligan's Island and The Brady Bunch. Join us for the next Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The concluding death scene of Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn, influenced how a generation of filmmakers choreographed violence on the screen. Now, at the age of 77, Penn is bringing his vision of cinematic crime to television. He's just been appointed the new executive producer of the hit NBC drama Law & Order. A Hollywood and Broadway veteran, Penn also directed The Left-Handed Gun, The Miracle Worker, Mickey One, Alice's Restaurant, Little Big Man, and The Missouri Breaks. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1989.
I want to go back to 1967 when you made Bonnie and Clyde, which was really a landmark film in part because of how you handled the violence in it, particularly the scene at the end where Bonnie and Clyde each take dozens of bullets and their bodies twitch with the impact long after they're dead. This film led Pauline Kael to say, Penn has a gift for violence. Despite all the violence in movies, a gift for violence is rare. Did you think of yourself that way, as having that gift?
No, I wouldn't have defined it that way, but I guess you have to understand that we were operating, of course, in a totally different social context in those days. It was in the midst of the Vietnamese War, and daily news, the news of that we saw on television, had body counts and numbers of soldiers wounded and dead. And it was a time where it seemed to me that if we were going to depict violence, that we would be obliged really to depict it accurately with the kind of terrible, frightening volume that that one sees when one genuinely is confronted by violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did in Bonnie and Clyde. Also, we were doing it at the same time with a kind of, at the end of the film, with an attempt to raise these two characters to a kind of faintly mythic proportion. So it was done in an extraordinarily complicated technical way, but the end result was to sort of propel them upward into myth, and that was the attempt, at least. And to some degree, I think we succeeded. We also succeeded in upsetting an awful lot of people.
Yeah. Can I ask you how you choreographed and shot that last sequence where Bonnie and Clyde are murdered with dozens of bullets?
Yes, but I'm afraid it'll be hopelessly technically difficult. Let me try and give you a short volume answer, okay?
Oh, please, yeah.
All right. One of the things that I attempted to do was to have it in different speeds. And the way you achieve slow motion in film is by actually running the film faster so that many more frames are exposed, and that's what produces slow motion. So the intention there was to get this kind of spastic motion of genuine violence at the same time the attenuation of time that one experiences when you see something like a terrible automobile accident or, in my case, certain occurrences in the war. It was this extraordinary stretch of time while these events were taking place. And so what I did was I ganged four cameras together, all running at different speeds, some at very, very, very high speed, and some at just double normal speed, some at four times normal speed. It was to get this kind of spastic, balletic violence. That was really the attempt, to really join time and space. And that's how we did it. In layman's terms, without getting into the technical aspects of it too deeply.
Now, I was just running back that scene last night on, mm-hmm. on my VCR, and I think the part where you really see the slowed-down action is just when Warren Beatty takes the first bullet and falls to the ground.
You were aware of it there, but it runs all the way through the scene.
So
it's all done in different time motions,
mm-hmm.
all the way through to the very end of the scene, including Faye falling in the car and her hands slowly bouncing, and then stopping.
Mm-hmm.
All of that was done by these four cameras in different speeds.
Correct me if I'm wrong, the sound of the bullet sounds like it's real time.
Exactly. We kept that, we decided to do it, I decided to do it, at a visual expansion of time and an auditory continuum of time in normal, apparently normal extension of time.
What, for disorientation?
No, actually for orientation. I thought if we disoriented the sound as well as we disoriented the film, that we would then be clearly engaged in the movie aspect of it. And I didn't want you particularly to be aware of the medium at that point. I was hoping that you would be caught totally by the nature of the action on the screen.
Was there a code in existence at the time that you made Bonnie and Clyde?
Oh, yes.
What did the code say about violence, and did you have any problem getting the film through? Because for its time, it was extreme.
No, may I try to correct a couple of things?
Yeah, please, yeah.
Yeah, first of all, it was not extreme. What it was that it became a cause célèbre because the critic at that time of the New York Times had decided to engage in a campaign against what he perceived as violence in films. And he was really objecting to many other kinds of films. When this came along, however, it provided him with the perfect launching pad for a real diatribe against our film and violence in film. And somehow we remained tainted with that. Now, he's talking about one kind of violence. Pauline Kael is talking about another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Pauline Kael's kind of violence that I'm really responding to with as feeling it accuracy and complementary. Because there's gratuitous, mindless violence, and then there is the depiction of how it really is. And I think that we depicted that by not doing it in an ordinary reportorial style. God knows we've been imitated thousands and thousands of times now by television shows. Every time you see kind of somebody attempting violence, they go into that basic slow motion. Well, in American films, at least, we did it first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about Kael here. Let me quote her again. She says that you put the sting back in death.
Well, as I say, in a context of the times where we were seeing it on the 6 o'clock news all over the country, bodies, helicopters crashing, people being killed, young men being rushed to the ambulances, there was a kind of desensitization in the nation to violence, and it seemed to us, to me, that it was important to depict it as it really is.
You fought in World War II.
Yes.
Were there images that stayed with you that influenced the way you've handled violence in your films?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little?
Well, they just simply were images. They were images mostly during the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them, and they were terrifying.
Were you injured yourself?
No. I was very fortunate. I wasn't really engaged in much action at all. But what little bit of action I saw was more action than I ever want to see again.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, as this controversy got stirred up about Bonnie and Clyde, you were back on Broadway directing the musical How Now, Dow Jones. I find that very amusing.
No, was I doing that?
I think so.
I think
yeah.
I was doing... I was doing Golden Boy with Sammy Davis.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, even so, quite a contrast.
Yeah, but my life has been filled with that kind of wonderful contrast of being able to work in the theater and in film.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with director Arthur Penn. He's just taken on the job of executive producer for the NBC drama Law and Order. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air.
Director Arthur Penn is my guest. Can we go back to 1958, to your first film, The Left-Handed Gun, which
Please.
Starred Paul Newman? And this was a psychological interpretation of the Billy the Kid story. How did you feel about making your movie debut in a Western that was going to be a new type of take on the genre?
Well, I felt rather exalted. First of all, the opportunity to make a film was
mm-hmm.
a pretty heady opportunity. And then, of course, to be... together with old friends, Fred Coe, who was the producer of it, Paul Newman, with whom I'd worked previously in television, and to be able to do a nice, modest little Western that had a quite different slant to it than conventional Westerns had had up to that point.
Did you feel that you and Newman took risks with his performance?
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, what kind of risks? What were you
well,
doing?
Well, we went from the sort of basic, tight-jawed, laconic Western hero who said yup and up to somebody who was engaged in other kinds of interpersonal relationships, and they were visible in that film, and I think that was what sort of rather startled the American critics, although it quite fortunately for me delighted the European critics, most particularly André Bazin.
There's a shot I have to ask you about. There's a scene where Paul Newman and a woman who's married to one of his friends kiss. And that scene kind of dissolves or cuts into a flame, a fire.
A fire.
And I was wondering, you know, whenever you see scenes like that in the movie, you wonder if it's like a literal interpretation of, yes, and then they had sex and we're not going to show it. Here's the heat of the flame. Do you know what I mean?
I'm afraid that you're quite accurate about that. You know, this was early filmmaking.
Right. And,
every once in a while, I got a little too romantic and too poetic, and it was more than a little embarrassing.
You feel embarrassed about that shot now?
Well, it's evidence of somebody who was just finding out what the medium could do. I was very intoxicated by the medium of film, having come out of live TV where we didn't have the opportunity to edit and prepare scenes and so forth, and then to be able to make a film.
Right. Well, sure, you worked on Philco Playhouse and Playhouse 90.
That's right.
Had you studied the method?
Sure. You mean the acting method?
Right, exactly.
Yes. I've been associated with the Actors Studio for 25 years.
Could you put into words how you've applied that as a director? I realize that might be too hard or too broad.
Well, in the shortest possible answer, I think it was an attempt to break stereotypes. And that's really what it was to get into some of the interior life of the characters. And that's what really we attempted to do in Left-Handed Gun, which was to take a Western and strip it of its kind of prototypical behavior and begin to get it down to direct, recognizable interpersonal behavior.
Well, you directed both the stage and screen version of The Miracle Worker. Did you have to rethink your presentation when you moved it from stage to screen?
Yes, I did, but I wish I'd done it more so. I wish I'd done more of understanding how the cinema could do certain things for us that instead we sort of articulated in language and that wasn't necessary.
What, for instance, would you have done differently now?
Oh, well, there are certain things in The Miracle Worker on the stage where we needed to have a voice of sort of opposition in order to have an obstacle, which is really what makes for a certain kind of conflict. And in that case, it was Captain Keller, Helen Keller's father, who was resigned to her terrible fate as a child who had no hearing and no sight. And Annie Sullivan, who, of course, insisted that the child could be in some way reached or hoped that she could. Well, on stage, it was necessary to give all that language and to have scenes that did it. When we put it on film, however, I wish I'd been aware that the camera could very well have provided us with a much more eloquent version of the enormity of Annie's problem, and we wouldn't have had to quite articulate it so melodramatically as we did in the play. Mm-hmm. But that was because it was only my second film and I didn't know what I was doing quite.
I watched that film about a year ago and was really surprised at how moody and atmospheric it looked. I had forgotten that.
Yes, well, we all have a nostalgia for black and white films, and they're really remarkable in terms of being able to evoke mood.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we all were doing many more of them.
Well, you'd like to work more in black and white?
I'm always attracted by that, yes, as a medium, mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes I go and I feel as if the screens are just so brilliantly colored you could practically get blood sugar from it.
Hmm. Do you have actors improvise much on the set?
No, not really. Not really. This is such an elaborate subject, but improvisation as it's practiced on a lot of movie sets is not really improvisation. It's actors writing lines on the spur of the moment, and that doesn't thrill me. Now, there are certain people who can do it, and every once in a while, they come up with some wonderful stuff. Brando does it and does it wonderfully. But for the most part, I prefer not to really improvise. On the other hand, I don't really start addressing the language of the script right off the bat either. It's just a way of sort of arriving at a scene in a much less formal manner until we're really ready to shoot. And at that point, I pretty much insist upon having the language of the script.
Mm-hmm. My guest is film director Arthur Penn. Your brother Irving was an acclaimed fashion photographer whose work was shown in many museums.
Is
shown in many museums, yes. And I'm wondering if there's was something in your background when you were growing up together that you think led you both to such visual directions.
Well, I would like to be able to point my finger directly at it, but it doesn't really exist. We didn't spend an awful lot of time together when we were growing up. We were just two children in a family where there was divorce at an early age, and I went off in another direction, living with other people during my childhood until I was returned to Philadelphia at time of last year of junior high school. And that's when I sort of rejoined my brother, and we spent several years together at that point.
Oh, he's older than you are?
Yes, he is.
Did he influence you in any way, help you out, give you any guidance when you started working as a director? I figure he was established a few years before you were in his profession.
Well, he didn't give me guidance as a director, but he gave me guidance as a person. He's enormously important in my life, and we're very close friends.
Mm. Do you remember the first movie you ever saw?
No, I don't, because it traumatized me. I went to see a horror film with my brother, and I ended up crouching down under the seat. I remember that. It was in some theater on the east side of New York. And I didn't then go back to films for years.
Because you were so afraid from this movie?
Yes.
Does your brother remember what the movie was?
No, we were both very young. I must have been 5, and he was probably 10 at that point.
So when was the next time you went back?
Well, it wasn't until I was an adolescent in Philadelphia, and I began to then be able to go to films with some pleasure. And then finally, when I saw Citizen Kane, that was really the turning point in terms of gratification from film.
Well, looking back now as an adult and as a film director, what does it say to you that this movie, whatever the movie was, had such an impact on you that you were terrified and wouldn't even go back into the theater? I mean, what does it say about the power of movies to you?
Well, there's no doubt about the power of movies. It's what in certain circles they call a counterphobic reaction, I guess, which is you get frightened by something and finally you decide, instead of staying frightened by it, you join it. And that seems to have been what turned out to be the case in my life. But I never anticipated it. I never anticipated being in film. I always was drawn toward the theater as an adolescent.
Would you like to scare children with your movies?
I certainly wouldn't.
Okay.
I think the films that we're seeing nowadays are much too scary. I think they're terrible, actually. I think that the degree of violence in them and the basic simple-mindedness of the plotting seems to me to be appalling. I could wish, at least for the Western to come back, it was a nice morality tale, you know? These are not even moral films, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. So, really, it's the artfulness and morality of the violence that
attracts me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there's something eloquent to be said about that, not necessarily always involving violence. I have a nostalgia for films like The Miracle Worker, you know? I would like once in sometime in the foreseeable future to go to the theater, film theater, and see something which was genuinely enlightening. Even a very good love story. There are far too few of those. We got all those macho executives out there doing macho films, and I think maybe we need some more feminine touches in the choices of material.
Arthur Penn from a 1989 interview. He's the new executive producer of the NBC drama Law and Order. Here's some more music from Penn's film Mickey One. This cut features Stan Getz.
Thank you.
Coming up, a review of the new film Bring It On. This is Fresh Air. Bring It On is a new teenage comedy starring Kirsten Dunst as the captain of a winning Southern California cheerleading squad on their way to the finals. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
There's nothing like a good high school movie, and as far as I'm concerned, they don't really have to be all that great to be fun. Like Gall, all high school movies are divided into three parts. First come the offspring of Rebel Without a Cause, morbid romances with a social conscience. One of the low-budget masterpieces in this vein was 1976's Massacre at Central High, the story of a picked-upon nonconformist's deadly revenge on his tormentors. It was a morally complex film, but nothing with its title could be made in today's censorious atmosphere. The second group, the least likable, are born from those stupid instructional films you used to see in school. You know, how to date without ever having sex, how not to have too much fun. This sad collection includes every movie ever produced, written, or directed by John Hughes. They preach conformity rather than group solidarity and insist that teen rebellion can never amount to more than a fashion choice. Finally, we get to the third group, the one epitomized by the luxuriating adolescence of rock and roll high school. A newcomer to this school is Bring It On, a comedy about a championship cheerleading team set at San Diego's mythical Rancho Carne High School. The team's captain discovers that its prize-winning routines have all been ripped off from a cheerleading squad at a black Los Angeles high school. Naturally, the kids at Rancho Carne are lily white, the presence of a single Asian-American kid on the team only emphasizing the school's narrow ethnic range. The movie opens with a zippy, in-your-face cheerleading number that effectively sets the mood. Cheeky as it sounds, it's even cheekier to watch. Actually, it's a dream sequence, all taking place in the head of the cheerleading captain, Torrance Shipman, who winds up the routine with a familiar nightmare. Her clothes disappear in the middle of her featured performance. Torrance is played by Kirsten Dunst, the actress who achieved notoriety as the Shirley Temple-like bloodsucker in Interview with a Vampire. In the years since then, Dunst has grown into an effective comedian, and she is terrific as the awesomely peppy Torrance. As she is shown in last year's Dick and her small bit in Wag the Dog, she was the actress who played a fake Albanian refugee, Dunst has solid comedy instincts. Somehow she knows how to go one step over the line with her characterizations, shifting her dramatic weight between the reasonably real and the craftily outrageous. Dunst is the film's strong card, a proselytizer of cheer, a pom-pom missionary. When Torrance's mother suggests that she might want to get another interest or two in her life, Torrance angrily retorts that cheerleading is her life and that some moms would kill to have a daughter on the cheerleading squad. No, Mom replies, that mother only hired someone to kill. If the movie overall were as strong as Dunst or as knowing as that scene, it would be terrific. but screenwriter Jessica Bendinger and director Peyton Reed can't seem to make up their minds what they want to do. At one moment, a cheerleading White Men Can't Jump, the next, a social comedy on the order of Clueless. Bring It On can't bring itself to pursue one aim with the same dedication its heroines pursue a national cheerleading title. And it seems leery of the anarchic spirit that made Rock and Roll High School the high school Uber film. Bring It On tiptoes between one thing and another, and the comedy never picks up the drive or shameless effrontery it needs. In other words, it's no Pom Pom Girls, another underground high school classic of the 70s. But it does celebrate the exuberance of rule-breaking like the best high school movies do. They are mostly comedies and all about how you can go beyond the bounds that are set for you by parents, schools, your friends, and even yourself. You can even go too far and the world doesn't fall from under your feet. And that message is worth a cheer or two, no matter how shakily it's delivered.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Chris Fraley is our engineer. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Dell Paperbacks Division, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer, with updated listings. This is NPR, National Public Radio.